Everything we've done in this class ultimately is going to execute on a processor. We've talked a lot about how we can enable really nice things like processes and this illusion of endless memory. Memory was a problem, so we added caching because we wanted to make that fast. But at the end of the day, we need to execute instructions, and the faster we can do that, the better our programs run and the more complicated programs we can run, and we have something to do with software developers. To do that, we looked at one idea, which is this pipelining. And the intuition there is, right, rather than wait till we finish an entire instruction, why not start the next instruction reusing hardware resources that we finished with for the first instruction, we can put them to use for the next instruction. Now, that doesn't make the first instruction sort of execute faster. It still takes the same amount of time, roughly. However, the ongoing throughput is much higher because for one more clock cycle, we get another instruction rather than having to wait the entire latency again. Okay, so that helped us with increasing the performance because we increased the throughput. But there's this issue, which is what happens when an instruction can't quite be completed directly. It needs to stall for some reason. And last time we looked at a figure like this. And really, I just want to focus on kind of one part here, which is if we have this instruction, it's a move, but it's accessing memory, right? And as we talked about, the reason we wanted to add caching is because memory can be very slow. Well, caches aren't perfect, so there's a chance we still have to go to memory, and that might take a while. And if you're a processor designer and you're looking at this, you're thinking, man, my processor's not doing anything, even with pipelining. I've got all these hardware resources and I can't do anything with them because I'm waiting for this slow instruction. And so very quickly, you're thinking like, okay, well, wait a minute. Is there something else I could be running in the meantime? Like, if I'm waiting for something to happen, you know, we do this all the time. We'll go and work on something else. If we're waiting for someone to get back to us, we can do something in the meantime. So why can't we do that with our processors, right? And that's this notion of out of order, is that this ad over here, for example, doesn't have anything to do with this memory access. So let's just run that now. All right, and so that's a way to really improve the performance because we can still do useful work even when we're waiting on something like this long memory. Any questions on sort of this premise? So we're going to see a couple things today. So we're going to see a little bit of examples where this stalling is something we want to work around. But just in general, we're going to want to have more instructions ready or at least under consideration at any given time so that when we can find cases like this where there's an instruction that we can actually execute, even though we haven't finished all of the earlier instructions, that we can go ahead and identify that and run it. But the trick is, how do we do that? And so we're going to have, definitely, this doesn't come for free, right? There's going to be more complexity here to enable this. And so our pipeline diagram gets a little bit more complicated. Some of the elements are going to be familiar, but we have to add a couple more key features. So we still have this notion that instructions are stored somewhere and cached to increase the performance of fetching the instructions. We still need to predict branches because when our execution hits a control flow point, we have to decide, do we think we're going to take the branch or not? And hopefully we get that right because then we can keep doing useful work and then eventually we're going to figure out if we were right or not. And so having a good branch prediction based on what's happened in the past to try to inform what's likely to happen again is very helpful. Decode is going to interpret the the machine code and the instructions. And really what's new and interesting here is we need register renaming. And we're going to go into a fair bit of detail on how this works, but this is going to help us understand how, when we have multiple instructions in flight, exactly what data each instruction needs. We dispatch into an instruction queue. And we've always got to keep in mind that when we're doing this out of order workflow, it can really help us compute more, use hardware resources that, so they're not sitting idle. However, we always have to be keeping in mind that programmers expect instructions to execute in order. Right? You would be very upset as a developer if your code sometimes things happened in a different order than the instructions you intended. So the processor can do these tricks, but it needs to make sure that what the outside world sees is what the programmer intended. Our instruction queue here in the middle, this is where we're going to be able to store multiple potential instructions so that we have kind of a, like a pool, like something to work from. Because they may not all be available to run, to actually execute, but maybe some are. So we want to have some options. To help enable this and to make this generic and work with a variety of different instructions, we're going to need more registers. And we'll see how we use these to make this possible in a little bit. But this is definitely going to add more complexity to the register file and the hardware for this. Since we have more, since we're adding the ability to run multiple instructions sort of out of order when they're ready, we can couple this with the ability to have multiple execution blocks, execution units, that will let us run, say, multiple ALU operations at the same time. Now here we're showing we have some that are single stage and some that are two stage. We'll talk about that. As well as this is also where we have our connection to memory for instructions that are going to access memory. We still have a write back stage to update the register file. And as I was sort of mentioning, this end stage, this new stage of a commit idea is very important. Because again, we need to make sure that what is observable matches the actual program and this order the instructions were actually in, not just the order that we decided to execute them in. We're also going to, here we can track which of our registers are still in use and which ones we will no longer need at that point in the program, and so we can reuse them to continue this process. We're also going to have to deal with what happens if we didn't get something right. So if we mispredicted the branch, what that means is we executed a bunch of instructions we thought we were going to want, but it turns out we didn't. And so it's very, very important that nothing about executing those instructions actually changes how the program operates. Because again, as a programmer, you would be very annoyed if suddenly your loop just executed one additional time or something. Right? That wouldn't work. So the processor has to guarantee that. There's also the chance that we did a memory operation and we didn't know that it was actually invalid. It was going to generate a seg fault. We didn't know that when we started the instruction. We learn that eventually. Well, at that point, we want to sort of interrupt the execution at that point, even though we may have executed more instructions. And so this idea of a commit and commit stage and reorder buffer is going to allow the processor to fix up those issues so that what's observable from the outside is what was intended. Any questions on this diagram? processor structure. So we've added a little bit of complexity, but we can still look at a sequence of instructions executing through these stages like we did before. We still have our fetch and decode. We're going to talk about rename and issue. Those are going to be sort of two major topics today. Execute is going to be very similar as what we've seen. Write back, and then we have the new commit at the end. And the commit is what's important to make sure that we have the what actually ends up happening at the end of the day matches what was supposed to. Now again, I sort of mentioned that this notion of adding out of order execution means we want to have enough instructions that we can look at one time so we can identify opportunities where this future instruction we can execute early. And so this kind of leads to wanting to be able to do things like actually fetch multiple instructions per cycle. Now, we can't just do that. We need, the hardware needs to support this. And so in simpler designs that we've looked at, we've said, no, there's only hardware to support a single fetch. Now we would expand that and have hardware to support fetching multiple instructions and decoding multiple instructions in the same cycle. The issue stage is going to actually select those instructions that can execute and then assign them to execution units so that they can compute. So if it's like an add instruction, for example, it needs to use an ALU. Now, if we have multiple ALUs, the processor may be able to choose or run multiple instructions that both need the ALU in the same cycle. And then finally, this the commit at the end here that I've been... What's going on? Okay, yeah. And the important thing here is we want to make sure that at the end of the day, these instructions from the programmer's point of view, that they actually executed in order. You know, we can see an issue here, right, where we were actually able to run this add a little bit earlier. But when we commit, we want to make sure that we're keeping that order as it was intended. Good with this? All right, so the first challenge, the first thing we're going to introduce to be able to help us actually do this in a systematic way. Because we can kind of look at instructions and go, oh, yeah, that one doesn't depend on something before. We can kind of run it. But how do we do this in a general way? Well, one of the first issues we can kind of see here. So if we look at, I'm going to choose three add instructions very specifically here. But these add instructions all write to R5. But they also use R5 as an input. And so if we just happen to look at, like, say, this instruction here, if we are able to execute multiple things at the same time or out of order, we need to be very sure that whatever we're using as the input for R5 is the correct value. Like, we don't want to get confused, you know, which one is it? And to help with this, we're going to use this notion of register renaming. What this boils down to is we have a set of registers that we're going to call architectural. This is what the x86 instruction set architecture, for example, says that the machine will have. Right? All the registers that we're familiar with using in different assembly instructions, those are the architectural registers that were promised, but that's an abstraction. That's the abstraction the processor is presenting to programmers. Internally, the processor can kind of do whatever it wants, as long as what the programmer sees in the abstraction stays the same. And so the processor internally is going to have physical registers. Now, they do the same thing. I mean, they're still it's the same register, right? It's a storing, a value, so that's the same. We're just going to have a lot more physical registers than what we said we had architecturally. And then we're going to have different names. All right, so what does this look like? So if we have our instructions, right, and those are the original instructions with the architectural register specified. So this is what we would expect to see. But then we're going to maintain a mapping between what was specified by the actual instruction and what we're going to use internally to the processor. And so that's this mapping here. So this table basically tells us the original architectural register and what where it's actually going to be stored inside the processor. So this is not exposed outside of the processor. This is all happening internally. And we're just doing this as a way to make it easier for us to reorder instructions so that we can understand exactly what the dependencies are between instructions. And so we're going to have some physical registers which are sort of in this mapping. They're assigned. They have a use. And then we'll have another list of physical registers which exist but are not currently being used. They're free. They're available. We can use them for the renaming. All right, so let's see an example of this, of what we mean when we say we're going to do the renaming. So we have our set of instructions as sort of specified by the programmer. Now, when we do this renaming, what we're going to want to do is we're going to map the architectural registers to the correct physical registers that we're actually going to use when we execute the instruction. So if we look at this instruction here, this add, all right, so the add has two inputs, R10 and R8. We're going to use those. We're going to look up into this table and say, okay, here's R10. And so we have a mapping. So when we rename, we're going to use the renamed physical register. And then R8 also has a mapping, and so we're going to use that as the other input. And so we can kind of write this out. So our first input is R10. So that mapping was to X19. And then our other input was R8. That maps to X13. So that's the inputs. But now we got to put that computation somewhere, right? It has to be stored. And so we're going to specify that. We're going to store that somewhere. Now, in the program, it's put back in R8. But again, we want to be able to separate different instructions, and we're going to use a unique physical register for this. Now, we can't use one that's already assigned. We have to use one that's available. So we're going to look at our free list and then use the next available register there. And so we'll assign that to X18. Okay, so now we've renamed all the registers that we're using. And so now it's going to be very, very clear exactly what values we need for the inputs and where the output is going to be. There's one more step we need to do. What is it? Yeah. Okay, yes, we do need to do that. Thank you for reminding me there. Right, so now, so we've used our X18, so that's no longer free, yep. So that's true, I missed that, so thank you for reminding me there. Yes? Exactly, right, so we have this mapping, but now we've changed the mapping, right? Because R8 is now going to be in X18. Okay, and so now we've done the rename for that instruction. Yeah? So why did we pull this output register from the free register list rather than use what's already in the mapping? And for this to work, we need to use a unique new register so we can keep track of exactly what instructions later need this value, right? The value that's generated by this add instruction as opposed to other versions of that value, of what's going to be in that R8 register over time. And so that way we can separate and run instructions sort of out of order, but we still know, because we know exactly the register that's going to hold the value, that we're doing the right thing. And we're not getting confused. Yeah? Okay, so we crossed out X13 here because we've updated the mapping. Do we need to keep that around? Like, do we need to keep the tracking that R8 is mapped to X13? So for the purpose of register renaming, we don't. Because at that, once we've done that instruction, the next instruction, that whatever was there before is sort of not relevant for the correctness of the next instruction. However, like eventually, we will, again, because we want this to look correct to the programmer, we will have to know that we did the renaming this way, and so then the output actually needs to eventually end up in in the correct architectural register. So if something happened like a seg fault and you observe the registers, they would be correct. Yeah. Okay, so what do we do with X13 here? We cross it off. It's no longer the most recent mapping. Can we put it in the free register list? The answer is no. We can't put it in the free register list right now because an earlier instruction might still be depending on that. We may have had an earlier branch that we still haven't quite figured out, and so it's not going to be available until later. So eventually, once enough instructions have finished, then we'll know, okay, nothing else depends on this. We can put it back in the free list. But we won't be able to do that during the renaming. Okay, so to clean this up a little bit, right, that's our sort of renamed instruction here with our updated mapping. If we look at the next instruction, okay, so we're going to still have an add. We can look at our input, so R11 maps to %x07. Our other input, R8, we look it up as %x18. Now, where do we get the output from? The free list, right? So we look at our next entry in the free list, which is X20. So this is no longer free. And what's our last step? Right, updating the mapping, right? So R8 is now not this. Good so far? All right, and if we do the last one, right, we can look up R12, so that should map to X5. We look up R8, that maps to X20, and then we'll use the next free register, which is going to be here, X21, right? And so if we do that, we should get that, right? Any other questions? So with this, right, we've resolved a lot of this ambiguity, right? Because we had this ambiguity about, okay, when you say, oh, we're going to use R8, well, which one, right? Which R8? Now it's very clear, right? This instruction here is very specific that it needs X20, and we know exactly where that's going to come from. Right, so even if we swapped these and executed the second add first, if we could do that, in this case we can't, but if we could, we would still know exactly where the second input to the third instruction needs to come from. So that's the benefit of register renaming. But so far, we've just looked at sort of arithmetic add operations. We can generalize this to additional instructions. It's going to work the same way. So if we have this first instruction here, add Q. So keep the same instruction. We look at our input, R10. That's mapped to X19. We look at our other input, R8, that maps to X13. Our output, right, same as we saw before. We need to use a free register. It's going to be 18. Now, at this point, we want to mark that that's no longer free. But we also need to make sure that we update R8 is no longer this. For all future instructions, it's going to be, for the next instruction before it's written again, is going to be X18. All right, now we have a move. Okay, and so this one's a little bit different, right? Because now we actually have a memory access. In this case, it's the memory address is sort of the output, if you will. So this is going to be a store. So how is this going to be renamed? Well, we still have our same instruction. We're going to have the input here, R8, so we can do that lookup. That's X18. We still need to rename this register, so we can do that same way. Look it up, RAX. It's right here, so our rename will be X04. Now, what do we do with the output? Do we need to use a free register? That's right. Right. So we're not going to need a free register here because this is a store. So we're just going to kind of denote that, say, okay, this is going to memory. But we're not going to update a register locally, so we don't need to assign one. Good with this so far? So at this point, we can look at something else that might be problematic. So we actually have two instructions here that are loads and stores, right? The first one is a store, and the second one is a load. But the addresses are stored in registers, right? So what would happen if this address ends up being the same as this address? Because we don't know what those values are, right? They could be computed to be the same. So what needs to happen in the second move here, the load? If they're the same. Well, we better get the same value as what we stored, right? Because if I write something to memory and then I read back that same address, I certainly expect to get the same value back, assuming I haven't done anything else in between. Right? And so this is another type of hazard, potential hazard, if these are the same. And the processor does have to take care to handle this correctly. But register renaming is not the solution here because we're going to have different register names. It doesn't tell us anything about the addresses or what it's going to be. And so we're going to need some other mechanism to handle this. And so that could be a couple ideas here. One is just to make sure that all loads and stores go out in order. So the memory will see them in the order that the programmer intended and responded the correct value. or actually explicitly sort of look for this case, and if we are trying to reorder loads and stores, make sure that if they do happen to be the same address, we're correctly handling that and making sure that the load is getting the correct data. All right, so that's a sort of an important note and another type of hazard that processors do have to consider. But getting back to our renaming, so we can look at the subtract, right? Same kind of idea. We looked at R8. We found R8 is X18. That's what we put here. R11, we look that up. That's X20. We found that as X7, right? That was here. Then when we needed the output, we looked at the next output register, was X20, and used that, but then we had to update our mapping for R11. Now, what's our move here going to look like? So if we do this one, we're going to move Q. We still have our same address calculation. We can look up R11. That's here. So we need X20. Now, this is a load, so our sort of other argument, if you will, is essentially going to be a memory access, but then we're going to write that into what we think is R11, but we can't use that. We need a new register, so we're going to pull from our free here. This is no longer free, and we can update our mapping for R11. For the sort of just the constant value, right, our input's still just the constant value, and really we just need to care about the output. And so we're just going to unconditionally change the value of R8. So we're going to look up a new free register here, use that as our output, but then just say, okay, R8 is now, it's not this, it's now X23. And then finally, our add follows, similar as we've seen. Yeah? How do we know when we can reuse a register? Because right now we just sort of have this free list that's slowly reducing in size. So the identifying what registers can be free is going to happen in the commit stage. Essentially, we just need to ensure that there's no in-flight instructions where we could have ever had a case where we mispredicted a branch and we need to go back in time, where there's no potential for a seg fault. There's nothing that's going to mean that we would need to undo an earlier instruction. And so at that point, if there's nothing that's going to use the output of that data, then the physical register is no longer in use and we can put it back in the free list. But that's about as sort of specific as we're going to get there. Yeah?
Can you do an example where previous register versions are actually reused? Because right now it just seems like you're overwriting the previous registers without, you're just discarding, for example, R11, you're just discarding X20. Can you show an example where the processor might need X20 again?
Okay, so let's think about this. So we've been crossing out these registers, right? So like we said, we don't need to keep that mapping anymore. But the reason we're doing that is because that's exactly what we expect to happen when our code executes, right? So where did we use X20? So we initially wrote it here, right? Okay, so that's where we did the rename there. That was for R11. So the output of this subtraction, whatever that value is going to end up in X20. Now, X20 is just the rename of R11. What needs that, right? So instructions after that are going to need that. So this instruction here needed to know that, right? Because the output of that earlier instruction that gets written to R11, that's going to be the input to the next one, right? And so we did that, right? So that's the renaming process. But what happens here? Now, when this move this load happens, it writes to R11. And so when we are thinking about these instructions, right, if we didn't have any of this stuff on the right, we would say, okay, this, whatever gets loaded is now what's in R11. Anything that happened before, who cares, right? This subtraction value, that's gone. I can't get that back. If I wanted it, I need to put it in some other register and not overwrite it. And so that's why we can cross off these old mappings, because from the programmer's point of view, like, that value is not needed. We can't get it back. It's going to be stored in the processor when we're doing this, but the code can't use it. And so we don't need to refer to an earlier version with a later instruction, which is why we don't need to keep that mapping alive. All right, should we try it? Take 3 minutes, 3-4 minutes, consult your neighbors. What's it going to look like to rename this series of instructions? All right, should we do some register renaming? So we have our same instruction. What are inputs going to rename to? So what's our first one? Anyone? Shout it out. 13, right? Because we looked up R8. Bam, okay. Other input? 17. What's our output register going to be? That's right, because we looked up in our free register. That was the next available one. That's no longer free. And what do we have to do in our mapping table? That's right, that's right. So our output's gonna be R9, so we wanna go here. It's no longer mapped to X17, it's now mapped to X18. All right, great. So let's see here. So move Q. Here we still have our 100, and we're just gonna unconditionally write this to R10. Well, we need to rename that to a free register, so we're gonna use X20. That's no longer free. And R10 is now not this, it is now this. For our subtraction here, we're gonna need our input, R10, we looked that up, it's X20. Our other input is R8, which we look up is still X13. Output, new register. No longer free, and we need to update, right? So R8 is now so far so good. All right, R8, we looked that up, 21. R9, 18. Output, something here. No longer free, mark R9 is now 23. And to sort of finish things off here, we look up RAX 04, R9 is 23, new output, and R9, we have to update. All right. Is that what you got? Any questions? All right, cool. So we can rename registers. It's a good start. That means we can put them into our instruction queue. And so we've kind of set up the mechanism. We've helped ourselves track what depends on what. However, we now need to talk about, okay, how do we actually use that so we can run instructions out of order potentially? And so to do that, we're gonna have our instruction queue, which is our renamed instructions, right? So you can see these all have the physical register names, the X registers. But we also need this new data structure called the scoreboard, which is gonna track which registers are actually ready. Which ones have data that we can use? And so we can see here that registers 1 through 5 have valid data and the other ones are still pending. The other thing that we have to consider for dispatch here and when we're gonna issue these instructions is the execution units. So we need, so if these instructions need to use an execution unit like an ALU, we need to have that hardware available. It can't be being used by something else, by a different instruction. So what's this gonna look like? So we're gonna start at the beginning, and we're gonna look for instructions that we can run. And what we see is that we can run the first instruction. Why? Because it's got 2 inputs, 1 and 5, and if we look up in our table here, we see that they're both ready. And so if both the inputs are ready, and there's an ALU open, right? So we were able to schedule it and send it to ALU1. That means we can actually execute that instruction. If we look at the other instructions though, I mean, we see like the next add is 2 and 6. Well, 6 isn't ready, 7's not ready, et cetera. So we really just have the opportunity to run this one instruction. All right, We look, so if we look at for another instruction here, we see, yeah, that we can't run it because even though we have ALU space, one of our inputs is not ready. However, eventually, after a cycle, that first instructions will finish executing. Now we do have 6, because that was the output, so it's now ready. Our scoreboard will reflect that. And so now we can look at the second instruction. We see, okay, is 2 ready? Yes. Is 6 ready? Yes. Okay, so now we can dispatch that. And so in cycle 2, we can have instruction 2 on ALU1. But if we look at these other ones, right, we still have the same problem we did before. Like 7's not ready, 8's not ready. So that's all we can run at the moment. When that cycle finishes executing, then 7 will become ready. That means that this instruction here now has 2, both operands are available and ready, and so we can schedule that and assign that and issue that to the ALU1. Still nothing else we can execute. All right, that's going to finish, and now 8 becomes ready. All right, so far, or at this point, we haven't really been able to use this out-of-order capability. Why? Well, because all of our instructions have sort of depended directly on the previous instruction. We can't start executing the later instruction until we know the input data, and so we don't have any ability to benefit from this. However, what happens at this point? So now we have this compare instruction, 4 and 8. If we look those, 4 and 8, they're both ready. So that's good. So let's go ahead and say, okay, we'll do that compare on ALU1. But what else is true in this instruction cache? All right, if we look a little bit further down, instruction 6, 1 is ready, 1's been ready, but it also needs 8, which is ready. Okay, so now we have an instruction here, this is number 6, that we can also run on the second ALU. This jump in the middle we couldn't run because 9 is not ready, 9 is still pending. And so here we can actually take advantage of the fact that we have these 2 ALUs, we can run these instructions, and we're running them out of order, right, because we're running 6 before we've had a chance to run 5. Questions? So this is kind of the other piece of functionality we need. We have the register renaming plus knowing which registers are ready gives the processor the ability to find instructions that it can execute at a particular time. Continuing on, so eventually 9 is going to be ready. And 2 and 10 are ready. So we'll add, basically on cycle 5, we can use both of those instructions with our 2 ALUs. But then we get back to the situation where 3 and 11 are ready, but 12 is not. Right, that's not ready, and so we can only do the 1 instruction here. And then finally our last instruction there. Yeah. Okay, so maybe there's like 2 questions there. So first question, we had this jump in the middle here.
Oh, sorry.
Ah, okay, okay, so not this instruction, okay. Right, so how do we find these, right? And so we can scan the whole instruction queue and look for what's ready. Right, do we assume the instruction queue is short enough that doing that scan is reasonable? In some sense, yeah, so yes, we're gonna operate that way, and in some sense, like, it wouldn't make, you know, we want the instruction queue so that we have an opportunity to find things we can execute. If we sort of ignore part of it, we're kind of potentially sacrificing some performance because maybe farther than we looked, there was an instruction we could have run. So these are not going to be huge queues. We'll see an example, but yeah. So what did these readies specifically mean at the beginning, right? So what that means is that whatever the previous instructions were that executed, their values were computed, and the correct value was placed in each of those physical registers. Yep. In what stage do we update the scoreboard to show that the register is ready? I think that's in the write back stage or execute. It's gonna happen because like we computed the processor needs to store the data from the ALU somewhere, and once it does that, it's also gonna be able to mark that yeah this is now ready. Yep. Yeah, so what's the CC? That's just noting that we care about the condition code that was computed from the compare. All right, cool. And so eventually, yeah, we get that final ready. All right, so let's try it. So see if you can determine when these instructions are going to use. We have two execution units, so just a single ALU, but we also have data cache, so access to memory. And then we're going to assume here this is one cycle per access. So the memory is going to take just one cycle. So we'll spend, 3 minutes, see if you can determine what cycle each of these instructions will be executed. All right, let's see if we can, when we can execute these instructions. So let's start at the beginning. Seems like a good place. Okay, first instruction. Is it ready? Can we execute this? How many say yes? How many say no? Okay. Well, so we can check. Okay, so we have this move. We can look. Okay, we have, it's going to need X4 to find the address, and then we're going to store that to register 6. Well, if we look at our input here, 4, it's ready. Great. So we can execute. The instruction is possible to execute, but we need to make sure that we have the resource available. Well, we can look at our data cache. Nothing else is using it, so we can assign an issue instruction 1 there. All right, cool. And so that will get us the value for 6. All right, so cycle 2. What goes in cycle 2? Well, okay, or some of you like, wait a minute. All right, so okay, what about this move? Let's look at instruction 2. That needs 5. It's ready. We can execute it. In this case, we can't. Why not? Yeah. Right, because our execution unit for the data cache is already occupied with the other instructions, so we can't have 2 there. We only have 1 sort of channel to this cache in this example, so we can't execute that. All right, great. So cycle 2. Wait. I see a couple people shaking their head. Why? Because if we look at instruction 3, what's true here? Well, it has 2 inputs, 1 and 2, right? And so if we look this up, ready. Aha. Uh-huh. So what that means is, we still need somewhere to execute it, right? But our ALU is available, so we can actually issue instruction 3 as well. Good? Yeah. Right, so why can't we run instruction 2? Why do we have to skip to instruction 3? The reason here is because this is also going to be a memory access, but our execution unit, in this case the data cache, is already busy. So we already scheduled something and issued something to it. We can't do that twice. We can only handle the 1 instruction, so we don't have the execution unit ready to run that instruction. So we're actually still on cycle 1. And so we couldn't run 2 instructions, the 2 memory instructions on cycle 1, but we could use the ALU for the 3rd instruction on cycle 1. So we benefit from the out of order. Now what happens? Okay, so cycle 1 is going to finish. Well, we're going to have our 2 instructions. We said the data access is 1 instruction, or 1 cycle. So our ALU operation, or sorry, our instruction 1 will finish, and that makes X6 ready, and instruction 3 makes 8 ready. All right, what can we do on cycle 2? Can we go back and look at this instruction, number 2? Can we run that one? Takers for run instruction 2? No, we can't run instruction 2. Okay, a lot of takers for it, right? Because we sort of said it was already ready. We just didn't have the execution unit. Well, now it's free because the previous instruction finished, so we can go ahead and issue that. Can we do anything else? So we still have the ALU available. Is there any other instruction we can run? Yeah, let's look at this 4th one here, right? So we check our inputs, 1 and 6. 1 is ready, 6 is ready, great. So let's go ahead and dispatch that. So when cycle 2 finishes, what happens? So instruction 2 will mark X7 is ready, and instruction 4 will mark 9 is ready. All right, and then we get to instruction 5. Can we run that on cycle 3? Yeah, right? And we sure hope that's true because we don't have anything else sort of outstanding. So we look at 1 and 7. They're both ready. And so we'll go ahead and issue instruction 5 there. Okay, any questions? Yeah. Sorry, can you repeat the beginning of your question?
Yeah, like the scanning, which instructions to run in the queue, does that take extra cycles?
Does scanning for the instructions in the queue take extra cycles? Well, so that is the cycle. So the issue stage is that the time for that stage is to scan that queue.
I was just wondering, like, when you write 3, like, by cycle 2, has the results of 3 already, like, came out?
So the ALU is taking a single cycle. So there's going to be one cycle where the ALU output is generated. We are going to know what that's going to be. And so during that cycle in the issue stage, we're setting up for the next one, right? So I think your sort of thinking is like good, like, wait a minute, how is this going to time? But this is sort of the complexity of pipelining, that things are kind of happening at the same, they are happening at the same time in ways that can be a little counterintuitive. But yeah, our goal is that we're going to be able to sort of issue something into the ALU every cycle if there's something ready. Yeah. Could a processor do 2 instead of 1 because they were both ready? I don't know if any processor has done that. I mean, it could. Maybe there could be a heuristic that would be better for some reason. But since we ultimately need things to commit in order, there is sort of a motivation to do the early stuff first so that we're not unduly waiting at the end. All right. So we've talked about renaming, talked about the instruction queue issuing. Another thing to talk about today is the ALU. So we've been using it. So far, we've only been considering sort of single-stage ALUs. We could have multi-stage ALUs. So something more complicated like a multiply, we might actually want to do the exact same for the exact same reasons. We want to break it down into chunks. Each chunk can execute in a shorter amount of time, and then we pipeline that. And so the first multiply is still going to take that full latency. However, after that, we can get a multiply finishing every cycle. But it is data dependent. So how long will it take to compute this? C times D, and then times B, and then that times A. Any guesses? So how long is it going to take to execute just this multiplication? Three cycles? Right? Because our sort of each stage is a cycle. There's three stages, three cycles. So just to go from the start to the end of that, that multiplication will take 3 cycles. But now for this one, so we're going to take B times that quantity. Will that happen in the next cycle? And the answer is no. So we need the output of that first multiply to be able to start the second multiply. We can't forward internally inside of here. And so this is going to take another three cycles. So it's going to be 9 total cycles. So even though we have the stages, we can't do the sort of internal forwarding. Okay, we can also have an ALU box block that's not pipelined but takes multiple cycles. So something like a divide operation, maybe it's not feasible to divide it up into those pipeline stages, but it takes longer than a single cycle, and so we actually have a way to notify and say, yes, this divide has finished. All right, we can see this in practice looking at, so here we have instructions. They've been renamed. They're in our queue. We're going to dispatch them like we did before, except now we have multiply instructions and add instructions, and then we have different ALUs. So ALU 1 and 2 can do adds, comparison jumps, and ALU 3 can only do multiply. However, ALU 3 is 2 stages. All right, so when we start this, what are we going to see? Well, we're going to look at our initial instructions here. We see that 1 is ready, 2 is ready, 4 is ready, and 5 is ready. So we can actually issue both of these instructions. We're going to put the add in ALU 1, and then the multiply is going to have to go to ALU 3. And so that's here and here, but remember the multiply is 2 stages, takes 2 cycles, so that's okay. So we'll just denote that the second half of that. The second cycle is going to be in the second stage. And we're not going to get the result back until after that second stage. So we've issued the first two instructions. On the next cycle, we know that we have 3 is ready because that was the output of the add, just like we saw before. 6, however, is still pending. Why? Because it requires that multiply, which takes 2 cycles. But we can find some more instructions here. 3 and 6. Again, 6 runs on the ALU 1, and 3 we issue to the ALU 3. Now, even though we don't have the answer from the previous one, we can still issue to the first stage because that's now freed up because the multiply is pipelined. And so when that finishes, now 6 is ready. However, the output here, this one is still pending, but the output here is going to be ready. Now, if we look at this compare, we have 3 is ready, but 8 is not, right? 8 was still pending, so we can't issue that. However, this multiply we can. So that's why we have the 7 here. Next cycle, now suddenly that compare is ready, and so we can schedule 4, or issue 4. And we have this additional multiply here. Once 9 is ready from this compare finishing, then we can issue that on the next cycle. And then we'll continue. Okay. So same idea, just we have 2 stages for one of the ALUs. Any questions? Yeah.
Can you talk about like what happens in the out of order processor when the branch predicts wrong? Like what the instructions just kind of like slide back up memory?
Yeah, so here we had this jump. We predicted a certain result. That's how we had more instructions after it that we speculatively executed. If it turns out we got that wrong, then we have to go back and basically erase all of the work we did, make sure that none of that actually shows up anywhere, so that the programmer doesn't see that that executed, those instructions were actually executed because they shouldn't have been, and then go fetch the correct instructions and continue from there. So there's definitely a cost to predicting branches incorrectly, because you do a bunch of work and then you have to throw it all away, which takes time, and then start again. Just a couple of quick things on register renaming. So some instructions might use registers that are not sort of explicitly specified. That's okay. We're still going to do the same renaming process. We might actually split them into multiple instructions to make that a little bit easier. But the renaming here happens just like it would, even if it's not specified in the original instruction. Same with condition code. So we've been sort of, you know, seeing this as we go here, that the compare output is still going to need to be stored somewhere, so we know which compare result we need to look at for the jump. And we sort of mentioned this of, well, we're looking through the instruction queue. There may not be something ready to run, and so we might still stall, because we can't totally eliminate that possibility depending on what the program is trying to do. The program might be trying to do a lot of memory accesses, all of which are going to take a long time before it can continue. We'll have to wait. But one interesting side effect of this is that we can have two programs, one of which is 33% larger. So it's running significantly more instructions, yet it takes the same time. Why? Because the processor is able to hide that that extra instruction operation by executing it alongside other operations, because it can figure out that it doesn't depend on them. So this is a lot of the benefit of having this out-of-order capability and why it's worth the complexity and hardware to implement this. Okay, so we're going to pick up from some of the ramifications of doing things like out-of-order execution, where we're executing instructions speculatively that we actually shouldn't have, and what types of issues can arise from that. All right, see you next week.